Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and we have an interesting theme to discuss today. We're going to take a look at an investigation into the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the case of Sirhan Sirhan and the CIA's MK-Ultra mind control operation. Now, for the vast majority of people, legislators, lawyers, the American public, it's way over. It's behind us. Why bring it up? Who cares? We care because we believe that the American public was lied to. We believe that based upon the original research of William Pepper, an international civil and human rights attorney based in New York, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, James Earl Ray, in 1967, Dr. King had received information, then reached out to Mr. Pepper regarding an essay he had written for Rambert's magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions. He was present at Dr. King's famous Riverside Church speech. William was the citizens chairman of Robert Kennedy's run for the Senate in Westchester County, and also a counsel for Robert Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, arguing, based upon his in-depth research, that there was a second shooter. A trial he is now trying to reopen in an international court. William has received undergraduate and graduate degrees from Columbia University, a doctorate in education from the University of Massachusetts, a Juris Doctoral degree from Boston College, and also has attended London School of Economics and Political Science. His most recent book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., published by Skyhorse Publishing, is the result of 39 years of research and gathering of documentation, more than anyone else in America, plus sworn testimonies on new confirmed information that will revise the history behind the assassination of King. Now the question is, can his meticulous research also change what we know about the death of Robert F. Kennedy? Let's go to William Pepper now in New York City. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Gary.
We started our conversation on Monday, July 28th, about the case of Sirhan Sirhan, who still remains in prison, and the assassination of Robert Kennedy at the Ambassador Hotel on June 5th, 1968. You shared some of the evidence that was never included in the trial, such as there were being 13 shots when Sirhan only fired two, the death shot entering behind Kennedy's right ear, whereas Sirhan confronted Kennedy from the front. The chief medical examiner, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, gave evidence that the killing shot was fired only an inch away, whereas Sirhan was at least 5 feet away. You also argued that the bullets were switched to frame Sirhan. So for those in this audience who did not hear that short interview, please briefly review the forensic evidence we are certain of that indicates there was a conspiracy behind the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy rather than it being an act of a lone killer. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. Well, you've started off with a good summary. In actual fact, the autopsy report itself by Tom Noguchi clears Sirhan. Sirhan was hit with four bullets at powder burn range from the rear. Bob Kennedy was hit with four bullets at powder burn range from the rear, where Sirhan was always in front of him, 5 to 6 feet away. And as you said, the fatal shot was fired about an inch from behind his right ear. The forensic examination of the tape recording that was made at the time of the shooting with the finest technological equipment available indicated that not only were there 13 shots fired, but that they were fired from two different directions. Sirhan firing from one side, of the senator and the second shooter firing from behind. Sirhan was set up to be a distraction. He was set up to be a patsy who would on cue stand up and fire two shots in front. Only two shots, because then his arm was pinned to the steam table, and while he continued to pull the trigger with his arm and the gun out of control, he only had eight bullets in his weapon, and over 13 were recorded and without question were identified. So just on the forensics alone, I think it's clear. The autopsy report came in very late after the proceedings started. It was withheld by the prosecution from the defense. The Los Angeles police also eliminated all of the ceiling tiles and door frames, which had bullets lodged in them, which could have been matched. And the medical examiner, Tom Noguchi, was not allowed during the trial to identify the bullet that was taken from the neck, allegedly from the neck of the senator, which he would have been able to identify or not as having come from the gun of Sirhan. Later on, in a subsequent hearing in Judge Wenke's court, it was indicated by experts that bullet did not come from Sirhan's gun. Now, Sirhan had been taken that afternoon to a firing range where he was to practice shooting his pistol at the time. And then after that, he was driven over to the hotel. And he went into the hotel looking for, there was another reception going on. He was looking to have some fun. He had a couple of alcoholic drinks. And he was picked up by a woman who actually became his handler. And she stayed with him, and she led him into the pantry. And it was her touch that was the key to getting him to stand up. And as he stood up, we have learned since then, and I'll tell you how we've learned that what he saw in front of him as he pulled out his gun was the target that he had seen and had been firing at with a human form at the shooting range. And that's where he fired his two shots at that target. Sirhan was a victim of what has come to be known as a RHIC, radio hypnotic intracerebral hypnosis technique that the CIA has developed. And that technique is very sophisticated. Sirhan was missing for a period of about 2 weeks when he was in a clinic. In that clinic, he was subjected to a process of hypnosis and the use of chemicals and the combination of them. So he was brought into effectively a mind-controlled state where he was capable of being manipulated, and that's what happened on the night of the killing. Now, how do we know that? We brought in Dr. Daniel Brown, who is a psychologist from Harvard, and is one of the leading mind control experts in the world. Dan spent over 70 hours with Sirhan, and he came away with no doubt at all that Sirhan had been subjected to that kind of mind control techniques. All right, now, none of this was introduced, as you said, none of this evidence was ever introduced at the trial. And the main reason for that was that his trial was thrown. His lawyer, his defense counsel at the time, was subject to a pending indictment himself and was therefore totally under the control of the of the state and the prosecution. He started off his opening statement to the jury by saying, "We are not here to free a guilty man." Throughout the trial, he indicated very clearly, and in his summation, indicated explicitly that our client is guilty. And the only question is what penalty you shall impose upon him. So the state, he conducted no investigation. There was no examination of the bullets, no forensic examination at all. He accepted all of the state's stipulations and was the most friendly collaborator that one can imagine. And that's why Sirhan did not have a fair trial under any circumstances. We located a number of witnesses who very clearly indicated that there were multiple shots being fired, after Sirhan's arm was pinned to the table, it was clear he could not have fired any shots at the senator from the rear. Two people fled, including the woman who was his handler, and as they raced out of the hotel, they proudly boasted that, "We got him. We got him. We shot the senator." It's amazing. And we had more than one eyewitness who heard them making those statements. So none of this evidence ever came forward, was ever admitted. And we have tried to get it into court. And it was the efforts were made in the state court system, then in the federal district court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we went up through the Supreme Court just simply seeking an evidentiary hearing, just an opportunity to put all of this evidence under oath before a judge and jury. We've been denied that. Sirhan has been denied that all these years, has remained in prison, and that is why, as you mentioned, I have just filed within the last 2 weeks a petition with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights asking them under the OAS Treaty to remedy this situation and this asking this out of country commission to give us the evidentiary hearing that we've never had. And that's where we are at this point in time, Gary, in terms of the legal proceedings. But Dan's work was impeccable, and it's in his lengthy report and analysis of Sirhan is included in that petition.
Now we have to break it down section by section. First, let's begin with more forensic evidence. Lay out your entire forensic evidence so that we have more than the fact that he fired twice in the front, yet there were 13 shots, that the Los Angeles Police Department, corrupt as it always has been, probably the most corrupt police department in the United States, intentionally with malice aforethought, destroyed a lot of the evidence, and no one was held accountable for it. Right. Door frames, ceiling tiles, they just destroyed it.
That's right.
And then get into the specifics about what we know. I interviewed Robert Blair Kaiser, an outstanding investigative journalist, who came on my program back in 1969 or 70. And at that time, I was not doing a health program. I was doing a program called Writers Forum. And he had written a book called RFK Must Die, RFK Must Die. And he said that when a top psychiatrist interviewed Sirhan, Sirhan would, under hypnosis, state, "Pay to the order of Sirhan, dot, 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 dot. Pay to the order of Sirhan, dot, 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 dot." As if he had been told he would be paid a certain amount of money for what he was doing, but this was not in his conscious mind. This was in his subconscious mind. And many other things came out when they put him under hypnosis. That was never made public. And Robert Blair Kaiser at the time said that it was very difficult to get any media. Nobody wanted to touch this because they thought it was not real. It was conspiratorial. So take us to your evidence now, please.
Well, when Sirhan was apprehended and taken away and put in a holding cell and then retained running up to trial. He was interviewed by two psychiatrists. One of the psychiatrists was for the prosecution, and the other psychiatrist, Dr. Bernard Diamond, was for the defense. And they both worked together to try to get Sirhan to effectively admit that he had shot the senator. Sirhan to this day does not remember anything at all, because a part of the program that I told you about, the RHIC program, is that it has the capability of erasing selective areas from the memory. So he did not know what actually had happened, but he does remember that they were badgering him almost in a team-like fashion that he should admit that he effectively had shot the senator. Now, what has not been known or revealed by anyone, as far as I know up to now, is that Bernard Diamond, who was his defense psychiatrist, was also a participant in the CIA's MK Ultra program, which began in 1953 and continued into the 60s with 162 programs, sub-programs, Gary, 162 different focused programs in MK Ultra, and assigned to over 80 universities in America for research. And Diamond was a part of that, of the professional group that worked for the CIA on MK Ultra, and here he was appearing as a psychiatrist for the defense. Now, his position as defense psychiatrist was, he felt he had no choice, he had to admit that Sirhan was in a trance at the time. But what he did say was that Sirhan put himself in that trance through use of a mirror. In other words, he didn't acknowledge the fact that there was an external intelligence force that had been used under the MK Ultra program's specifications to effectively hypnotically control him. And he never brought out the fact that Sirhan had been put in a clinic and had just simply disappeared for a period of 2 weeks. That was never actually brought out. At the trial, Tom Magucci, the medical examiner, was not allowed to give the basic testimony with respect to the forensics and what he observed. And we have included his lengthy autopsy report, which itself clears Sirhan from the shooting on the basis of the ballistics evidence that was just blindly ignored by his defense counsel. So I think if one is looking for the important elements that have established this man not getting a fair trial, it's one, the destruction of evidence that I mentioned earlier that the Los Angeles Police Department undertook to accomplish, and it is the number of bullets that were fired that indicated very clearly that there was a second gun being discharged at the time, and the location of the firing and the actual entry points of the bullets themselves into the senator's back and into his neck and into the fatal shot behind his ear into his brain.
So okay, let's just hold that for a second there, yeah. Because we want to keep the pieces together, but understandable. So what we have up to this point is, as one of Sirhan's co-attorneys, you were responsible for getting the courts to agree to have Sirhan placed under hypnosis. Now, the dilemma was that although Sirhan freely admitted to being the shooter, he had no memory or recall of the event. He remembers being at the Ambassador Hotel, being in the lobby, meeting with a woman, perhaps the woman in the polka dot dress, but then he has no recall or memory of pulling the gun and firing.
No.
The next thing he remembers is being pinned to the ground with the football player and actor Roosevelt Greer on top of him. So that's what we know from him being under hypnosis. Now, let's just step across this line and say, okay, we know that Sirhan was speaking to you about some of his past and also as a mental patient in an institution that may have been affiliated with the CIA's MKUltra psychological and brainwashing research. And some speculate that Sirhan had contact with one of the pioneers of modern hypnotherapy, Dr. William Bryan, who we know for certain worked in the CIA's MKUltra program and its early operation, what was called Artichoke, Operation Artichoke, and developed a technique known as hypno-conditioning. And Dr. Bryan, by the way, is the best-known person for inducing the Boston Strangler to confess for his murders under hypnosis. But it seems there were other psychological handlers connected with the CIA that dealt with him. So what is the CIA's connection with Sirhan? Why would they want to have Robert F. Kennedy killed? And they wouldn't possibly have done this unless they knew, just like the killing of his brother, John F. Kennedy, they had connections with J. Edgar Hoover, they had connections right up to the top, Lyndon Johnson, that they could get away with it. So this had to have been the deep state working by coordinated departments with many individuals involved, including the depth and the nature of MKUltra and its experiments and its motives. And is there any evidence that the CIA was experimenting with mind manipulation to create unwilling assassins or killers, much like the ones that we have seen in some of the historical movies with Frank Sinatra and later with Denzel Washington, of the Manchurian Candidate type, where someone is living a normal life, they're under hypnosis, but not a normal hypnosis, because under normal hypnosis, you cannot be conditioned to do something you would not normally do. You couldn't kill someone. So go into this part of it now, because now we're involving the CIA, other agencies. What we know, and I'll get later to what Candy Jones personally told me. Candy Jones is a person who acknowledged, come forward, that she was in the MKUltra, was being brainwashed, and she was on WMCA while I was on WMCA, and her husband, Long John Neville, had one of the more interesting programs, one of the more iconoclastic programs in the history of radio. So take us there now, please.
Well, you pretty much summarized fairly quickly what happened. After the Second World War, there was a movement on called by the U.S. military and the Office of Special Services to bring over German scientists who had been working on mind control techniques during the war. The Germans actually had started this work in 1882, and then they collaborated with the Brits in 1921 and again at the Tavistock Clinic in 1932. And then at that point in time, Hitler and the Nazis took over. And so the Germans were developing the use of mind control techniques using drugs and hypnosis. At Dachau, they used mescaline along with hypnosis, for example. And at Auschwitz, you had the infamous Joseph Mengele dealing not only with eugenics, but also with various types of psychological implantations. That was carried out in the United States initially started off by a Yale professor called Jose Delgado, who developed a technique of implanting in the brain a device which effectively rendered people under control. So the Americans picked up from the Germans, brought their scientists over, and headed that list, of course, was Reinhard Gehlen, who was Hitler's chief of intelligence, and who was probably the father of the Cold War, because that's why they brought him in. So there was this collaboration using the Nazi techniques and scientific developments from the concentration camps, even into the American scene. And then after the war, they started with a program called Chatter and moved on to you have described Bluebird, which became Artichoke. And these were programs that were designed to affect interrogation techniques and enhance interrogation techniques. And then that culminated in the consolidation of what has been known as MKUltra in 1953. So the American intelligence, and it's not just the CIA, Gary, it's important to understand that the American military and naval intelligence were involved in this, as well as NASA. It was a multi-agency involvement with various degrees of responsibility and interest in developing these things. And most frighteningly, they have come down to the modern times, and they have used a degree of electromagnetic device and attacks. And I have known people, and my research had to locate people who were subject to electromagnetic intrusions, and have gone into how that was not the case in terms of Sirhan, but that has certainly been the case in more recent years, and those effects are absolutely devastating. Sirhan was worked on by Dan Brown, our psychologist, both under hypnosis in the prison and on free recall. Dan was able to get him to recall the clinic where he was put and the techniques that were used with him, as well as to remember some of the other patients who were there and what was happening to them. So that was a major breakthrough for us. Gary, I only became involved with this case in 2007, after Sirhan's original lawyer died and others came to me and the family came to me and said, would you look at the evidence? And when I looked at the evidence, I became convinced this was another instance of a totally unfair trial, and so I had to then get involved. And that's when I brought in Dr. Brown, and we started to work on what you rightly said that Bob Kaiser picked out in the first instance. There were, for example, introduced into evidence writings in notebooks that were taken from Sirhan's home and his room. The writings were in his own handwriting, and they were meant to be incriminatory. They were meant to reflect a hatred for Bob Kennedy, which never came out in terms of any of the conversations that he had with anyone, frankly. Sirhan was a Palestinian, but he was a Christian. The mainstream media has, throughout all of these years, neglected to stress the fact that he is not was not an Islamic Palestinian, but was a Christian, and came as a youngster to America and grew up in the United States in that context. Those writings, Dr. Brown was able to trace as having been shortwave radio dictated to him by a man he ran into in a cafe where he used to hang out. And this man, and he describes him, used to show up there, and he used to show up also occasionally at the shooting range where he was as well. And he had this kind of ability to communicate by shortwave radio and was dictating, and this is again part of the whole hypnotic event dictating what he should write. Sirhan did not own the writings. He did not understand how he wrote, but why he wrote those things, except it was pulled from him that this is what he was told to write. They were introduced at the trial as though they were free expressions of hatred for Robert Kennedy, and there was no attempt to ascertain where they came from or how they were developed. So that was another example of evidence that was put in that did not have really a proper defense exploratory explanation or even an investigation of any kind whatsoever.
We're going to take it a little different direction now. If you're just tuning on, I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is the program each week where we go into great depth on one topic that is not covered by the mainstream media, but we feel is important. My guest is William Pepper, and William Pepper is simply one of the best constitutional and criminal lawyers anywhere. And I want to go into something with him in a moment about why we should pay careful attention to what he's doing. But what he's telling us is they had to set him up. He had to be a patsy. But unlike Lee Harvey Oswald, who was not, to our knowledge, put under hypnosis, Sirhan was. They also tried to make it look like Sirhan, who was a Palestinian, was angered by Kennedy's support of Israel and the U.S. supplying of 50 bombers to the Israelis to be used against Palestinians. This was in his notebook, and he said he felt betrayed by the 1967 Six-Day War. Now, we have Sirhan's notebooks, which I assume you have looked at in great depth, and we know also that he was fascinated with the occult, especially hypnosis and acquiring psychic abilities, and was involved in the Western Rosicrucian occult tradition and perhaps theosophy. And his notebooks have scribbled over and over again in it, RFK must die, repeatedly. Mm. And yet, even in his trial, though he admitted guilt, Sirhan stated he had no ill feelings towards Robert Kennedy at all. So that didn't make any sense of these pronouncements, which would seem to indicate a clear motive. And then, but the press was not interested in this. The press accepted that Sirhan murdered him because of his geopolitical reasons. But here's what was not said, and up to this moment, no one has known. I was approached by a person, a rather well-known person, and who was aware of my investigative reporting at the time. I'd broken some major stories. And this person said that they were very concerned about their daughter, who they could not get back to reason. This person was like in a cult. They said, quote, my daughter's in some cult. We feel that we're losing her to this cult, and all she wants is money. And can you look into it? And as a favor, I did. And the more I looked, the more concerned I became. Because there were multiple cults at that time, and a lot of them were messianic, complex, people running them. But then there were some that, including one called the Process Church of the Final Judgment, which opened a church in Los Angeles in early 1968 and then mysteriously closed only days after Robert Kennedy's assassination. Now, we may remember that Charles Manson and many of his followers were connected with the Process Church. And for listeners, the Process was headquartered in London by a couple who were former Scientologists, and Sirhan seemingly showed interest in this group. And one Process member was a chef at the Ambassador Hotel. And it seems Sirhan visited a friend at the Ambassador the day before the assassination. And also, there has been speculation, and again, it's speculation, that the Process, similar to other occult organizations such as the Temple of Set, founded by Dr. Michael Aquino, a high-ranking military officer specializing in psychological warfare, were involved in the CIA's mind-controlled MKUltra operations. And they had their own kind of mind-control apparatuses similar to some of the CIAs, or perhaps the CIA infiltrated and worked through such cults like the process because his followers were psychologically fragmented, such as Sirhan, and easy suspects for CIA experiments. Now, do you have any additional thoughts to that? And by the way, I later was able to get the daughter. I had some reasoned conversations with her, managed to get her of her own volition come up to a place I had, a farm upstate, and did a whole detoxification with a friend of mine who was with the Albert Ellis Center, the famous Dr. Albert Ellis, who I knew. And this was one of his chiefs of staff. And she was able to regain normalcy and go back into her life. But that was just one. And that was a whole lot of effort and work. And I did this very quietly. You know, if you start talking about these issues to the media, they're going to think you're a nut job and not have anything more to do with you, and nor the media. But someone who was very willing to have this conversation actually sought me out because of what I've been doing was Candy Jones, who was a longtime radio personality on WMCA radio and had a highly respected, though what might consider esoteric and idiosyncratic program with her husband, Long John Neville. They did the overnight. I was there in the afternoons. They were on overnight. So do you have anything to add to this? And if you do, also, what can you tell us about the strange woman in the polka dot dress and who many believe was connected in some way with the assassination? You mentioned earlier in our program today that her touching him set his signal to be activated, and then Bragg leaving the hotel where at least two witnesses heard her and her companions say, you know, we did it. And years ago, I had the scholar on Nazism and the rat lines, as well as American conspiracies, Peter Lavenda, on the program. And he suggested that through his research, this woman may have been, are you ready for this? Candy Jones, and who was a bombshell entertainer in the kind of the, if you looked at her, she reminded me of Mamie Van Doren, who I thought was, as a young kid, adorable and exquisite, and Jane Mansfield. She had that kind of effervescent, dynamic personality, very beautiful. And she frequently performed before the troops and after the war devoted her services to the OSS, which became the CIA. And Lavenda claims she was later programmed to have a dual personality, one as an assassin through the CIA's MKUltra program, and there also are some suggestions she was also involved in some way with the Process Church. Now, again, those are speculations. I want to be clear on this. Candy told me this stuff in detail. We had long conversations on this. What do you know about any of this or its legitimacy?
Well, I think, as you say, a lot of it's speculation. But there are some relevant facts. One, Sirhan was motivated to become involved with the Rosicrucians. And the Rosicrucians, as you know, may be looked upon as being one of the types of groups that you are mentioned, that you mentioned. And that involvement can be overblown because he never really was that seriously involved, but he did attend meetings and he was interested in the the occult because so much of the mind control history that we know about, you know, going back to Project Paperclip that I mentioned after World War II and the consolidation of German spies and scientists with the Americans after the war, has a basis all the way back to the Book of the Dead of the Egyptians. Would you believe? In terms of the occult and a fascination with the occult and the use of the occult for the purposes of hypnotically training people to do various jobs that they do. And what you mentioned about dual personalities is also very relevant because that was a part of the structure of the of one of the MK Ultra programs to do that. Now, you raise also earlier the reason behind the assassination of Robert Kennedy and why Robert Kennedy had to be killed. Bob Kennedy was going to do several things that were simply objectionable to the people who rule this country, the ruling forces. He was going to reopen the investigation of the assassination of his brother. He was going to end, as was his brother, end the oil depletion allowance. He was going to go back and do a historical examination of the underpinning of the Federal Reserve Bank and that legislation back in 1913. Bob Kennedy had come to believe that there was this type of nefarious oligarchic, behind-the-scenes oligarchic rule of the country. And he was determined that he was going to try to unearth it. And that became known to some people who are very close to him and around him. And unfortunately, it's become my view that in at least one or two circumstances, those people served to help facilitate his assassination. That is one matter. With respect to the woman in the polka dot dress, we've spent a fair amount of time on this, and I can't at this point in time go into a great deal of detail, but I actually think that we are very close to identifying her and knowing where she lives. She is still alive and married, and we are looking for the final evidence that is necessary before moving at all in that direction. But yes, this woman was specially trained and specially equipped to do what she had to do. And she came to Los Angeles from another state with this specific training and instructions to do what she had to do. There's no question about that. The identification of the second shooter is another matter. And we have also some indications as to who that person, who was a pro, absolute pro, who knelt down behind Bob Kennedy and put the bullets into him, and then was able to get up and leave very quickly, because Sirhan's whole role in terms of his preparation and his training and conditioning was to distract. And that's exactly what his two shots did. They distract.
William, let's put this in perspective at this moment. You're trying to get the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is related to the Organization of American States, which the American government is a signatory to, and therefore would be important to have an evidentiary hearing.
Yeah.
And that's what we're hoping for. You'll keep us up to date on that. But I want to spend the rest of the program doing this. A lot of people right now are listening and they're saying, who is this guy? And why should we believe him? Well, I want to get the audience to understand a little bit more about you. You had a press conference on my program and the Progressive Radio Network within the last year, where you broke the story about who really killed who killed Martin Luther King Jr. I'm going to ask you some questions. I just need very short answers to get it in as much as we can before the show's over. All right.
Sure.
Were you able to prove to a jury that there was a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yes. In 1999, a civil trial took 30 days with 70 witnesses, took the jury 59 minutes.
Okay. Were you able to prove that the shooter was not James Earl Ray? He had nothing to do with it.
Yes. The jury accepted that.
Were you able to prove that the people involved, including Clyde, the ex-lover and second-in-command at the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, was actually the go-to person in this conspiracy?
We didn't have, at that point in 99, we didn't have the evidence for that, but I got the evidence subsequently, and it's all under oath, and it's all under deposition. The entire depositions are contained in The Plot to Kill King, the last book.
Did you also find that the actual shooter is still alive and work for the police department as a detective?
He worked as a police officer. He was the best shot on the Memphis police force, yes, and I had lunch with him, so he wouldn't eat.
All right. Was it also the case that they had reconnoitered and the CIA had its own people there in case the shooter missed, they would have a second shooter finish the job?
The military did. The Army, John Downey was the head of the military intelligence group, and he had a 8-man SWAT team there as a backup with 2 shooters and 2 spotters, and they were never going to let Martin King leave Memphis, and they were there to do the job if the civilian sniper on the ground failed.
Did the people in Washington, including J. Edgar Hoover, he hated Martin Luther King, did he work directly with, or his associate work with, the Dixie Mafia, knowing that the Dixie Mafia controlled people within the police department, controlled the media there, and could cover up any of the problems or get rid of anyone who was a problem?
Yes, there's absolutely no question of that. And, of course, Frank Holloman, who was the chief of police and fire in Memphis at the time, had worked in Hoover's office for a number of years, so he was impeccably trusted.
And was there not a person still alive who was the son of the head of the mafia in the Dixie Mafia who talked about getting the money in bags brought to him from Washington, D.C.?
Absolutely. He described the money being brought in by Clyde Tolson, and also instructions from Hoover being brought in by Clyde Tolson, Hoover's number two.
And on the day of the assassination, wasn't King's room moved?
The room was moved when he arrived at the hotel, not on the day of the assassination, but before. When he arrived, they moved the room. The room was moved from room 202, which was a secure, protected ground floor room, to 306, which was an open balcony room.
And who caused that move to be made?
Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Okay. Was there any reason Reverend Jackson would have made that request?
He was asked to do that by the conspirators.
Okay. Do you have proof of that?
I have a sworn statement from the son of the, that you mentioned, of the Dixie Mafia leader, who was present when his mother made the phone call to arrange for Jackson to do this.
And what would have been the motive of someone who's claimed to be a close affiliate and a friend and respectful of Martin Luther King to put this onus, this burden upon himself to do this? Why would he do this if this indeed he did?
For money, and also because he had been collaborating all along.
Collaborating with the FBI?
Collaborating with the FBI and local police and the conspirators.
So are you suggesting or stating that Jesse Jackson was a rat?
Well, I guess you could say that.
That's the terminology.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Let me tell you this. I interviewed every one of a black power group, Black Panther group in Memphis called the Invaders, and they knew Jackson very well. And what they told me, and I can't verify it because I never saw it, but they said when he left South Carolina to go up to Chicago, he carried with him a letter from Strom Thurmond that said to Richard Daley, take good care of this boy, he's one of our own. Now, I have to make it clear, Gary, that I never saw that letter. And I was just told this by members of the Invaders who really didn't like Jesse Jackson. So one has to look at that and just put it on balance. Okay. What I'm telling you with respect to the change of the room, however, was sworn to. I grilled the informant of this, who was present when it was going on. Now, was I present? Did I hear any of the conversation? Do I know for an absolute fact that Reverend Jackson did these things? No. I just have reported what I've been told and what evidence I have been able to obtain.
Because these are very strong statements, and you could end up getting yourself sued for libel or slander, depending upon if it's restated or in print. I'm merely putting this forward so that if Reverend Jackson, and I said this on my show, if you would like to come on the show and challenge Mr. Pepper, if you believe that you have been wronged, you have a forum and you can offer your challenge. And did you seek Reverend Jackson to ask him directly the information you had, or at least what was alleged about him, so that he could respond before you finished your investigation?
No, I didn't do that. One of the concerns I had was the safety, and this is a problem that you face in cases like this, is the safety of the informing witness. I had, when I had the actual shooter identified to me by a janitor at the police department rifle range, I couldn't use his name. I was afraid that they would kill him. So I had to wait, quite frankly, for some years until he died. But I'd had him videoed and sworn under oath, and I had his statement as to who the shooter was. But I couldn't use it because I was afraid of the safety of the witness. For better or for worse, that was a decision.
All right. So what we have at this moment, let us be clear and unequivocal. We have allegations made by a group of black radicals in Tennessee that they didn't like Jesse Jackson. That doesn't confirm that he indeed did anything illegal or unethical. And you have another witness who claims similarly, and you're claiming that he was an informant, but he has every opportunity to come forward and say he was not. These are specious and libelous statements, and clear his name.
Yes, that's certainly true.
And also, in our highly litigious society, if someone made such a statement, I know someone made any statement about me. I've sued people and won. I sued ABC. I sued Dr. Dina Dow. I've seen a lot of people, when they make a statement, it's inaccurate. If someone accused me of conspiracy and killing, you know, one of the greatest people that ever lived in America, you bet I'd be litigious. So I'm interested to see what steps Jesse Jackson takes this moment to challenge you on your allegations.
Well, remember, this statement has been in the plot to kill King since it was published in June of 2016. It's been out there for over a year in print. Now, litigation is one thing, and I have done my share of litigation. But once you get into litigation, you go, as you know, down the road very quickly into discovery. And if anyone sues me, or Jackson or anyone else were to sue me, we would go very quickly into discovery. And I think the results of that discovery would not be very pleasant.
Okay, finally, is it true from your research and the testimonies and the undersworn evidence and depositions filmed and recorded and signed to that when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot, he was not dead and taken to a different hospital than what would normally be done? And there it was witnessed that a top person put a pillow over his head and smothered him.
Yes, that's right. He was St. Joseph's Hospital may have been the closest. I'm not sure of that. But in any event, the instructions were pretty clear to the mafia people running it by the head of neurosurgery, who happened also to be their family doctor, by the way, that if the bullet didn't kill him instantly, make sure he goes to St. Joseph's, because we'll make sure that he doesn't leave there alive.
So he could have been resuscitated, and a nurse leaving there saw them put a pillow over to kill him.
Well, he was still breathing. You know, he might, in fairness, he might very well have died from the wounds eventually, but they were not going to take that chance. And the head of neurosurgery, Dr. Breen Bland, entered the room with two men in suits, and he said to the emergency room staff, "Stop working and let him die." And then shortly after that, he said, "All right, now all of you get out of here." And as they were leaving the room, she heard them come up with spit in their mouths like this. That caused her to turn around. And when she turned around, she saw them spitting on the body of Dr. King. And then she saw the head of neurosurgery actually take the pillow and put it over his face and extinguish him.
Yeah. Now, finally, so they plotted to kill him. They had backup teams to kill him. They shot him. They didn't kill him. He went to the hospital, and their men in suits and the top person smothered him. But first they slandered him and used racial epithets against him, then spat upon him. And you have that evidence, and you have that videotaped and deposed, correct?
That is videotaped, and that is the videotaped deposition under oath of the son of the woman who has passed away, when she called the family together the next morning and told the family everything that happened, and her first words were, "I don't know why they had to kill him." But that is all under oath. That's right. And
okay.
It's
now, finally, and this got to be short because we're out of time, you subsequently, in 39 years of research, tens of thousands of hours, meticulous documentation, you proved to a jury this happened. They found James Earl Ray innocent in a civil case and found these people guilty. You later confronted the shooter. You later confronted other people involved in the conspiracy. So you wrap this up neatly. Wouldn't you think that someone in the media, 60 Minutes, 2020, Dateline, Nightline, someone would find the compelling evidence, since you are a highly respected, worldly attorney who's never lost any of these cases, more research than all the other lawyers combined on this. No one has even reached out to you. That should tell you a great deal about the power of the deep state.
I think it does, Gary, and you know better than just about anyone the control of the corporate media by the ruling forces of this society. They don't want these cases out and heard. And it's the rare person, and I must say you fit that bill, Gary, and thank goodness for what you do, but it's a rare person who will allow the public to hear about these things. You know, when I came back from Vietnam, and Martin read my article, of course, and that's how I came to meet him very quickly, Bill Atwood of Look Magazine asked me to meet him, and I did. And as I walked into Look Magazine's offices, they wanted to do a nationwide piece in Look on my Children of Vietnam article. He shook my hand and said, "I had a visitor last week. You may be pleased or not pleased to know." And I said, "Who would that be then?" And he said, "Averill Harriman." I said, "What did Governor Harriman want?" He flew in from Washington to give me the president's best regards and to ask me to do a favor for the president. And the favor was that I should never publish anything that Bill Pepper wrote. And he said, "Now, what do you think of that? You're not even 30 years old and the president of the United States." I said, "I'm more interested in what you said to him." I said, "We're going to see you next week. And if we like what you said and your documentation, we were going to publish." The problem was the next week after he met with me, he met with Jim Garrison. And he called Bob Kennedy at 1 o'clock in the morning after the meeting with Garrison. And he said, "Bobby, the district attorney in New Orleans has convinced me that the CIA killed your brother, and I'm just shaken to my shoes." Bobby said, "We know it, but I've got to have the White House in order to reopen this case." Bill Atwood had a heart attack 3 hours later and was off Look Magazine. Of course, none of these articles ever ran. And
Bill, we're out of time. We got to run. I thank you very much for coming on. At least people see that when you're doing investigation on Sirhan that no other lawyer has done, it's merely a continuity of what you did in your impeccable work, legacy work on Martin Luther King Jr. And we appreciate you coming on and sharing this. Thank you.
Gary, thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and here we're not afraid to share the truth. Have a nice day, everyone.